This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. Talking about Bill Cosby is still a third-rail conversation for Black people, according to my guest, W. Kamau Bell. He speaks from experience. He directed a 4-part documentary series called We Need to Talk About Cosby that's now on Showtime. The final episode is this Sunday. The series is about Cosby's importance in American culture and the special place he held in Black culture as a comic, sitcom creator and star, educator and philanthropist, and how through much of his career he was also a serial rapist. About 60 women have come forward, and there are still more women who are reluctant to come forward. The series examines Cosby as America's dad, his secret life of drugging and assaulting women, and how the two timelines coincided.
When you look at the number of stories of women who've come forward saying Bill Cosby assaulted or raped them during this time, and then you look at the number of accolades he got, you see they skyrocketed together. Around the same time he released his book Fatherhood and Hollywood was crowning him with yet another Emmy and 2 Golden Globes,
Bill Cosby,
The Cosby Show.
He was guest hosting The Tonight Show.
My next guest is a very talented actor.
And according to many, abusing his power behind the scenes.
I was raped and I was afraid for my life, thinking he could do more. I informed a lawyer, I informed a police officer. But at the same time, I thought, will anybody believe me against him? No. Will I have the money to fight this? Such power and wealth? No.
Several other women were also interviewed by Bell about how Cosby drugged and raped them. Kamau Bell is a comic who was inspired by Cosby and grew up watching Cosby on TV. Kamau Bell also hosts the CNN documentary series United Shades of America, in which he travels to communities around America talking to people about the challenges they face. The series has taken him to places you wouldn't expect a Black man to go, like a Ku Klux Klan rally. W. Kamau Bell, welcome back to Fresh Air. It's really good to talk with you again. The series is great, so thank you.
I appreciate that. Yeah, thank you.
So how is talking about Cosby still a third rail among Black people?
I mean, I really do believe that for anybody who was sort of alive during the height of his power or for the rise of his power, it's a third rail conversation. It's just, I think if you're Black and you were alive for that, you're just adding more electrified rails to the conversation. I think it's hard for anybody because, as we say in the series, he was America's dad during the Cosby Show, not Black America's dad, America's dad. And I mean, there's people as far away as South Africa who feel like the Cosby Show changed their lives. So it is hard to talk about just generally if you're any race of American, but as a Black person, we are still and always have been under a deficit of role models who are promoted to stardom. So it doesn't mean that we don't have them in our communities, but as far as the America allowing them to take the public microphone and be celebrated, we're not represented well. So it's hard to lose somebody, especially someone as big as Bill Cosby.
Let's talk about what Cosby meant in Black culture, especially to people like you who grew up with him in the 70s and 80s. So what did he mean to you growing up in the 70s and 80s when he was all over TV in many different roles?
I mean, specifically, not only was he all over TV, which we talk about in the second episode, he was all over kids' television. I think that's the part about it that is so why like I really feel like, as I said in the series, I'm a child of Bill Cosby. As a kid, I'm watching him host Fat Albert and the Cosby Kids. At the time, I didn't know he was doing the voices and also writing it, but I was like, oh, I like the guy who hosts one of my favorite cartoons. And then he's also on The Electric Company on PBS. And he's also on Picture Pages that happens during Captain Kangaroo. So he's just sort of like a lot of the places I go as a kid for content. So everywhere I'm going, he's not that far behind or he's in that thing. So it's just, you know, you sort of grow up with this idea that Bill Cosby is a part of the wallpaper of Black America. And then I also was aware that he was some sort of actor who my mom might see him in a movie or might see him on a TV show. So he was everywhere. And then as a kid who's becoming a fan of Saturday Night Live and stand-up comedy, Bill Cosby himself comes out. And I remember renting that VHS and watching it. And even as a 10 or 11-year-old, I was like, this is better than the other stand-up comedy. It's really, now I look at it as a masterclass in stand-up comedy. It's not a level of comedy that most comics will ever come close to achieving, including myself. And Bill Cosby himself is basically a pitch for the Cosby Show. He's talking about himself as a dad who's overwhelmed by his kids and they're getting one over on him, but he's still holding it together and his wife is smarter than him. And those are all the elements of the Cosby Show. And when that show premiered, it was bigger than anybody could have imagined. Like the ratings it got, no show gets today. And the only show that would be disappointed by those ratings is the Super Bowl.
Did you want to be part of the Huxtable family?
I was a part of the Huxtable family. I don't think it was like I wanted to be. I was Vanessa's age, but of course I felt like Theo. You know, you could just imagine yourself, and I think a lot of kids my age is in that family because there was some kid you were sort of close in age to, and the show looked like it was welcoming you in, and it was black in a way that was. It's funny, as much as it got criticism for not reflecting the average black family, whatever that means, it was, you know, there's black music, there's black art. He's putting like Sammy Davis Jr. in roles. It just feels so black in a way that black people can relate to and that people who aren't black just sort of go, oh, this is good. I enjoy this.
One of the things that I learned from your series, which I thought was fascinating, was that Cosby was responsible for bringing black stuntmen into television. So describe how he did that and why he did that and what white stuntmen used to do to be doubles for black performers.
Yeah, so let's be clear. Some of this stuff apparently still goes on in some sense, but this was definitely the way it was back in the day. So, and just to be clear, this was the story that when I first heard it, I was like, it's Bill Cosby's fall is more than just the fall of a funny comedian. There were things he did that you look back on and go, that actually changed the world and made the world better for people. And we don't know all these stories. And it feels like we have to know these stories because we're going to lose our history. So, Bill Cosby, as a young comedian, gets on the Jack Parr Show. He, you know, he's an instant hit. That leads him to getting the show I Spy, where he becomes the first black person to be the co-lead on a television show with Robert Culp. And it's a spy show sort of in the Mission Impossible sort of theme. And he's like an action adventure show. And he's like a suave equal of the white guy on the show. He's not his manservant. He's not his butler. Him and Robert Culp are equals, which was the first time that had happened in TV history. And apparently, the story goes that he... on the set of I Spy in the first season, he gets to the set and he sees a white man being painted black. And they called it painting down. But this white man was literally being painted black, not being painted brown like the color of Bill Cosby, being painted black. And he asks what's going on. And they say, that's your stunt double for the stunt that we're doing today. That guy's your stunt double, this white man being painted black. Apparently, Bill Cosby sees this stuntman being painted black and says, if you don't get me a black stuntman, I'm not going to work on this show anymore. I'm done. And this is a story that has been told specifically by Noni Robinson, whose family was in the stunt industry. And she was working on a documentary about the stunt industry and how Bill Cosby revolutionized it and changed it in that one act. And so people who talk about when the black stunt industry got integrated point to that act. It's not like a bunch of different things that happened and he was one of them. They point to that act, that Bill Cosby at that point, he's new to a TV show, feels like he has enough power or enough intestinal fortitude to go, I refuse to be on this show if you don't find me a black stunt performer. And they did. And we talked to that man in the series.
And he brought other black professionals into his shows, too, like from writers to makeup artists.
Yes. I mean, that's the other thing he did, especially once he got to the Cosby Show. He made sure that, you know, he understood at a time when nobody understood this, and people still don't understand this, that the true power is behind the camera and that diversity on camera doesn't mean anything if you don't have diversity behind the scenes. And also, on a black show, you want to have black people behind the camera because it will make the show be authentic. You'll feel it on camera. Black makeup artists know how to do makeup for black people better than white makeup artists do. So a lot of people in Hollywood who are working and have worked for 30 years can point to them being hired on The Cosby Show as the beginning of their career.
At what point in Cosby's life and career do you think he started actually raping women?
All I know is the first accusation we know about is very early in his career in the mid-60s. So it is not a thing where I think a lot of us who hear about these stories but don't really study them or don't really read them, think that maybe it happened later in his career after he'd gotten the power, but that's not the case.
On your series, people tell you about a section during rehearsals of The Cosby Show that was reserved for very beautiful women, for models. Tell us about that section.
So we talked to Joseph C. Phillips, who played Martin on The Cosby Show, Lily Bernard, who guested on a couple episodes, and Stephen Watkins, who was also a stage manager on The Cosby Show. And they talk about that during rehearsal, you would look out into the bleachers where people sat, and there was clearly a section where there was just nothing but young, model-looking women. And that when rehearsal ended, they called it the parade. Those women would just sort of, there would be a line of them parading to Bill Cosby's dressing room, and they would go in there one at a time, and the door would close, and whatever, we don't know what happened in there, but that's what would happen regularly on the show, and they called it the parade. And then we heard about a man named Frank Scotti, who Stephen told us about, who was one of Bill Cosby's main assistants, that there was some level of, like, coordination with modeling agencies to send them over there. And the idea being that, like, he's a big star gets what he wants, he's the biggest star at NBC. And as I said before, I think at that point, and who knows, it's just framed as infidelity, all of it is. And maybe with those models, it was just infidelity. And as I've said before, if you're offended by infidelity, you don't need to be in show business because that you're going to see a lot of it. So, and I think I really wanted to bring that up to be clear about the fact that, like, a lot of bad behavior can be hidden in these situations like show business because the star gets what the star wants, and then the whole infrastructure of the project is trained to look the other way. So that, like, if you see something, even if you think it's infidelity, but if you look at something and go, wait, that feels like something wrong is happening, you've been acculturated to look the other way. And as I've said before, when they built Hollywood, they said they didn't start with the human resources department. So there's no place for you to go where you can safely go, I saw something, please help me, unless without feeling like you're going to get fired.
So is it your understanding from the people you spoke to that there were probably people within the industry who knew what he was up to and maybe were even enabling him to continue or at least happy to look the other way?
You know, I think this is where it comes down to, like, we have to remember this is bigger than Bill Cosby. So there's lots of specifically powerful men in Hollywood getting away with a lot through the history of Hollywood. And some of that stuff is criminal and some of that stuff is just boorish behavior. So I think you have to remember he exists in an ecosystem of that. And I think so. Maybe I think, and again, I think there is a sense of, like, the more you move up the food chain, the more I believe you have to know, or the closer you are to him. So I think I understand that if you're a cast member on the show, that you're just trying to do your job and keep your job, and you're been trained to look the other way. So I can understand if you say I didn't know what was happening. But if you were somebody who worked closely with him, like Frank Scotti, who basically before he died said I felt like a pimp and talked about giving women money and things, and it felt like he wasn't talking about infidelity. You know, so it feels like I think there's certainly people who knew more than other people. But I really get careful about, I don't want to blame any one person who is just on the set of the show, because I think, again, the culture of Hollywood is such that, you know, again, the casting couch has been weaponized to excuse bad behavior.
I'd like to play an excerpt of one of the stories you were told by, in this case, by Patricia Lair Stoyer, one of the women who was drugged and assaulted by Cosby. And talk about how they met and how she ended up being alone with him when she didn't expect to be.
So, yeah, Patricia was a student at UMass. She saw that Bill Cosby was giving a speech at UMass where he was going, getting his EDD. And she said at the time she didn't really understand why a comedian was giving a speech about education. And then she went and was very impressed with him, and then later met him, and, you know, he fixated on her and invited her to, apparently it was, he said it was going to be like some sort of event with Jesse Jackson. She said sure. She ended up going. That ended up not happening, and she sort of realized she ended up on a date that she didn't understand that she was on. He found out that she wanted to be a singer, and then he said he would help her in her career, and ultimately that's how he got her alone, I believe, in his house.
Yeah, he told her that she was invited to a dinner party at his home. She was expecting maybe she'll meet his family. Instead, she's the only person at this dinner party. And
which is a thing that many of the survivors tell stories like that.
Where they were expecting to be with other people, and they ended up alone with him.
Yes.
Yeah. And then he has her do this like weird acting exercise, but she doesn't understand why is he having her do this. And he keeps saying like, oh, take a sip of this because you need to relax. So she takes a few sips and, take another sip. You need to relax a little bit more. You're not getting this exercise right. And then she kind of wakes up and doesn't know what's going on. And we'll pick up the clip from there.
And then the next thing I knew, I was waking up at 2 a.m. and Mr. Cosby was standing over me. I was in a bed, naked, under the covers. He was standing over me in his bathrobe with a toothbrush, waking me up, telling me that I needed to go.
What are you thinking when I'm curious, you're confused.
I was very confused, Kamau. I was also sicker than I had ever felt in my life, sick to my stomach. And I said to him, what happened? And he said, oh, you threw up and passed out in my powder room. I had no recollection of that. And I said, where's my dress? And he said, oh, I had to wash it. It's over there. And I believed him because I still believed in his reputation and therefore believed that I had just humiliated myself utterly in front of this famous man who had offered to help me. I made it all about my responsibility and my embarrassment and my shame. It never occurred to me that he'd sexually assaulted me. All I thought of was I just humiliated myself.
I think some of the things she says in that emerge as themes from all the other women or from most of the other women who you spoke to, including feeling like, oh, I just humiliated. I must have done something wrong. What did I do? This is humiliating. So do you think of that as a theme?
Yeah, I think that this is, again, this is so much bigger than Bill Cosby. This is just the way into the conversation. But this is how rape culture works. And this is how women have been trained to respond even when they've been sexually assaulted or raped. We have taught and promoted the idea that, like, well, what were you doing there? Why were you with this man? What did you think was going to happen? Why did you go there at that time? And so there's stories of like Victoria Valentino, after she's been raped by Bill Cosby, she asks for how am I going to get home? And he points at the phone and she says, thank you, while she's still sort of.
He points to the phone saying, you can call for a cab.
Yeah, he points to the phone saying, call for a cab, after he had driven her to this place, her and her friend. And she says, thank you, because we're sort of trained to say thank you, even in situations where you shouldn't be saying thank you. And I think this is, again, the part of it that we're talking about rape culture and the idea that like, that it's very easy because of how we society works in America to for the victims to start blaming themselves, which you have another survivor says, I was victim blaming myself. And so the idea being that like, I've done this to myself, and because of his reputation, as she says, and this is before the Cosby Show, it only got bigger, that there's no way he would have done something wrong, so I must have done something wrong because he's Bill Cosby.
And all the women seem to think, I'm the only one.
Yes, that a lot of the women seem to think that they had a weird experience with Bill Cosby or a weird few years with Bill Cosby, not understanding that they were one of many. And I think that's, again, it's how rape culture works. This is how we don't do a good job of sex education instruction in this country, full stop, so that we're not talking about how there's not generally talk in sex education class in schools about how predators act, when really that's what we need to be talking about.
Patricia Stoyer, who we just heard from, is white. Some of the women he assaulted were white. Some were black. Is there a ratio of white to black women? And do you think there are ever like racial overtones at all in the women who he chose?
All I can know is what I was told and what I learned through this process. Like when we talked about the parade in episode 3 on the set of The Cosby Show, you know, Lily Bernard's very clear that it was all colors of women that were in that parade. According to Lily, a third of the survivors are black women. I think it's easy to extrapolate from the fact that there would be other women out there who wouldn't come forward because they've seen how all these other survivors have been treated. And I think it makes sense to extrapolate from that like, there's probably more black women who could come forward, but it's harder for them to come forward than it is for a white woman to come forward, and it ain't easy for a white woman to come forward. So all we know is that more than 60 women have come forward, but we certainly can't trust that that's everybody.
Did you feel personally betrayed by him because you had looked up to him as a child? You grew up with him. You thought of yourself as a Cosby kid.
Did I... I guess some aspect of this is probably betrayal, but I just felt confused. I just felt disheartened. I just felt sad, I think is really what it comes out. It's just like, why do you have to be this guy? Why does this have to be the case? And I think some people have taken that sadness they felt and weaponized it against the survivors. But I just felt like in mourning over who I thought Bill Cosby was. And I was always aware that I couldn't just sort of cut him out of my cultural DNA. That like, and, you know, when I started to make it in show business, and they would ask me, who are the comics that you really liked when you were coming up? And I felt like I couldn't say Bill Cosby. But I felt like I couldn't not say Bill Cosby. So it became this thing where I was like, well, how do I play this? Because I can't deny that I was inspired by this man. But I also can't deny that if I say that, it sounds like I'm somehow like ignoring all of these sexual assault and rape allegations. So I just felt confused and conflicted and was having this conversation well before I ever thought I would be put in a position to direct a series about it.
Well, Kamau, congratulations on the series. I think it's just really, like, interesting. I learned so much from it that I didn't know, and it's just really absorbing and filled with insights about, you know, culture and deceit. So thank you, and it's always a pleasure to talk with you. Thanks for coming back on our show.
Thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure to be back, and I really appreciate you for having this conversation with me.
W. Kamau Bell directed the documentary series We Need to Talk About Cosby. The final episode will be shown this Sunday on Showtime. He's finishing work on a new season of his CNN documentary series, United Shades of America. Serial Productions recently released its latest investigative podcast series, The Trojan Horse Affair. It's co-hosted by Brian Reed, a veteran producer at This American Life, who hosted the podcast series S-Town, and Hamza Syed, a doctor-turned-reporter living in the UK. Podcast critic Nick Hua says it's Serial's best show since S-Town. Here's Nick.
A letter, a national scandal, and a mystery. These are the starting points for the latest podcast from Serial Productions, called The Trojan Horse Affair, which follows an investigation that wouldn't feel out of place in a John le Carré novel.
This is my first story as a journalist. I hadn't planned for it to be my last story as well, but given what's happened in the years I've been working on this, it probably will be. It's about a letter that surfaced in my city and had huge consequences for Britain. This letter launched four government investigations, changed our national policy, and ended careers. It's hurt some of the country's most vulnerable children. A letter that many people who've seen it agree is ridiculous.
It's unsigned, undated.
Didn't it look like a serious document, did it?
It just seemed comical. Like, what the hell is this?
Except, of course, this is no fiction. In 2014, an anonymous whistleblower leaked to the British press a photocopy of what appeared to be a secret communique. One that supposedly revealed an Islamist conspiracy to take over schools in the English city of Birmingham. The document would later be widely regarded as fake, but that didn't stop a nationwide panic over Islamic extremism infiltrating schools and beyond. Capitalizing on the moment, conservative politicians took the opportunity to stall a movement that sought to help immigrant communities improve education outcomes by integrating their culture into school curriculum. The panic also resulted in the implementation of harsh counterterrorism policies, which made life more difficult for Muslims living in the UK. Known as the Trojan Horse Affair, referring to a phrase used in the letter, this scandal is generally recalled in the country these days as a mess best kept in the past. Of course, not everybody has the privilege of moving on. In Birmingham, a city with a sizable immigrant Muslim population, the Trojan Horse Affair ruined careers and thrust vulnerable communities deeper into the void. Remarkably, despite everything caused by the letter, the writer's identity and motivation had remained a mystery. This is where the podcast begins its inquiry, and leading the investigation is an unlikely duo. Brian Reed, a veteran producer at This American Life, and Hamza Syed, a former doctor turned journalism student. A Birmingham native who happens to be Muslim, Syed is intimately familiar with the scandal, and his burning interest in uncovering the remaining unknowns of the Trojan Horse Affair is the catalyzing event for the series. He's the one who brings the story to Reed, along with a belief in the remedial properties of the truth. Solve the mystery of the letter writer, and perhaps you'll be able to rectify the effects of the letter once and for all. Or at least, that's the hope. What ensues is a thrilling audio documentary. Definitely Serial Production's very best since S-Town, which Reed also hosted. It excels in bringing you inside the investigation. You feel the excitement of excavating a new document, a new lead, a new name. At the heart of the podcast is the partnership between Reed and Syed, who also produced the series with Rebecca Lax. There's an air of a road trip movie to the proceedings. We are privy to the duo as they collaborate, compromise, argue, and riff. This adds a fun layer to the mix, but the experience takes on a richer dimension when the series reveals itself to also be about the different ways of looking at the role of journalism in the world. Reed and Syed represent different perspectives on the matter. They differ in nationality, journalistic experience, and of course, racial backgrounds, and the way in which the series handles their sometimes conflicting perspectives feels like a genuine revelation. It's not uncommon for narrative podcasts to feature multiple hosts, but rarely are they made to interact, much less confront each other.
Do you think we'll change anyone's mind? About anything? Is that even an important ambition to hold, or does it not matter?
I don't think about that when I'm doing a story. Because I feel like it will often lead to disappointment. The things that motivate me to do a story are because it's a good-ass story, and I want to tell a good story, and I feel like it can have all sorts of byproducts, like changing people's minds. But for me, I think I would get disappointed a lot. Whereas, like, if you're doing a story where you personally want to know the answer to something, you personally want to do the best story you can, then that's, like, where I try to derive the motivation from, you know?
No, I didn't know. Why would you do a story if you didn't care what impact it would have?
We hear the tension between the two perspectives flare up later on in the series. Like during an interview with a person who dismisses the negative effects of the Trojan horse letter on the country's Muslim community. The interaction leads to Syed losing his cool, effectively ending the interview and causing Reed to be frustrated. It's a tricky scene, one that underlines how the story's stakes are different for Syed as a British Muslim and Reed as a white American. But it isn't a critique of Reed's approach either. Rather, it feels like a working through of the tensions between different journalistic norms. The Trojan Horse Affair is a story with no easy conclusion. As Reed and Syed tumble deeper down a rabbit hole, it becomes increasingly apparent that even if they were to figure out the truth of the Trojan Horse letter, what that revelation would lead to isn't so clear. And given how neatly this podcast plugs into contemporary political anxieties here in the United States, particularly with the uproar around critical race theory, where this investigation goes ultimately leaves me with an unsettling feeling. The truth that they find is messy, unexpected, and inconvenient to the story other people want to believe. And so it raises the question. Even if you are able to find and speak the truth, does anybody care enough to listen?
Fresh Air's Dave Davies has the next interview. Here's Dave.
Our next guest, actor Matthew McFadyen, is one of the ensemble cast members of the hit HBO series Succession. He plays an aspiring business executive from the Midwest so well that American audiences might be surprised to learn that he's British, with a long list of credits in British stage, TV, and film. Many will recall him playing the dashing Mr. Darcy in director Joe Wright's 2005 version of Pride and Prejudice. He starred in a series which aired on AMC called Quiz, based on the true story of a man convicted of cheating on the original British version of the TV show Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. And he stars in the forthcoming film Operation Mincemeat, about a secret effort in World War II to keep the Nazi invasion of Sicily hidden from the German army. In Succession, McFadyen plays Tom Wamsgans, who's dating and then marries Siobhan Roy, who's one of three siblings competing for control of their aging father's media empire when he retires or dies. Tom is a player in the corporate intrigue, but as an in-law, he's never quite on an even footing with Siobhan and her brothers. In this scene from the first episode, the family's celebrating the patriarch's birthday with a picnic and a softball game, and Tom, hoping to ingratiate himself with the old man, approaches and gives him a case bearing an expensive watch, a Patek Philippe, and it doesn't exactly go over. The patriarch, Logan Roy, is played by Brian Cox. Matthew McFadyen as Tom speaks first.
Hey, so, just wanted to give this to you in person just to say, you know, happy birthday. So. Oh. Mm. It's just a, it's a Patek Philippe, so.
It says Patek Philippe.
Yeah. It's incredibly accurate. Every time you look at it, it tells you exactly how rich you are.
That's very funny. Did you rehearse that?
No. Well, no. Yes. But.
Okay.
Okay, let's play ball.
Oh, boy, painful. Well, Matthew McFadden, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you for having me.
That scene is from the beginning of the series. And you know, I'd never heard of a Patek Philippe watch. And I went on, online and I discovered that there's one that's a pre-owned one of them available for $120,000. And poor Tom offers this gift, doesn't even get a simple thank you. Boy, this kind of lets us know it's going to be rough for Tom and this family, doesn't it?
I think it does, yeah. That was my first inkling into what might lie await for, in store for Tom, if the, you know, if we went. And also, when we were shooting the pilot, we didn't know it was going to go on. So I thought, you know, there were these sort of markers about what might happen to him. But that was a really, that was a fun scene to play with Brian. I'm a big watch nerd, so I know all about those Pateks and all those sort of crazy watches and how much they cost.
Well, you know, one of the things that people say about Succession, especially those who say they don't like it, is that none of the characters are likable. You know, actors like to feel invested in their characters. Do you agree that these people aren't likable?
They're not especially likable, but they're not monsters. So they're not in, you know, there's always some sort of sympathy there. And I think, you know, they're humans. And so there's always a sliver of something. You know, and I think the interesting thing about all those characters is those perennial themes of power and love and family. It's a family dynamic, you know, and it's the sort of absence of love from the father figure, Logan Roy, around whom everyone sort of orbits. And so you sort of, I feel a great deal of sympathy for them in a strange way, because they don't, often it seems to me, they don't have an awful lot of confidence because they don't feel terribly loved by their father or their mother, indeed.
Well, your character, Tom, has two really important relationships that run throughout the series. One of them, of course, is with his wife, Siobhan, known as Shiv. They actually get married in season one. And what a wedding that is. Tom adores her and gets a lot of pain in return, right? And Shiv, on occasion, tells him she doesn't love him, even though she knows he loves her. She floats the idea of an open marriage. Here's a scene on in the series where you, as Tom, are at the beach with Shiv, and you're kind of getting fed up with this, and you push back, and we're kind of catching the scene in the middle. Siobhan is played by Sarah Snook, and you, as Tom, speak first.
You told me you wanted an open relationship on our wedding night.
So you've been stewing on that?
Well, yes. I have been stewing, actually. I'm not a hippie, Shiv. I don't want to do threesomes.
Okay.
On our wedding night? Bang! Shanghaied into a open borders free trade deal.
It was just an idea.
Well, that's a biggie just to throw in at the altar. I don't think it was cool what you did. I think a lot of the time, if I think about it, I think a lot of the time, I'm really pretty unhappy.
What are you saying?
I don't know. I love you, I do. I just, I wonder if the sad I'd be without you would be less than the sad I get from being with you.
That's our guest, Matthew McFadden, and Sarah Snook in a scene from Succession. So does Tom really love Siobhan, or does he love, I don't know, everything that comes with it, you know, access to power and wealth?
I think both. I think he does love her. I don't think he knows. You know, it's always that thing. You start asking those questions, but really, I don't think they have any hard and fast answers. He would say that he does. And he certainly loves all the reflected glory and power of being a Roy, you know. But I don't know, it's interesting. Sarah and I are often asked, you know, why are they together? And we talked to Jesse a little bit and we sort of thought maybe there's a, you know, there's a nice idea that perhaps Tom came along when Shiv was in a very low place and, you know, they got together and he's sort of safe and he's not a threat and so she'll never leave him. She'll probably have lots of affairs and one-night stands, and you know, but he's never going to let her down.
Right, so she can, someone that she can count on, whether or not she is fully invested.
Exactly, and he's happy to sort of suck that up and, you know, shimmy his way up the greasy pole in Waystar and all the rest of it.
I got to bring this up. You know, I think your appearance in Pride and Prejudice, you know, I'm sure Siobhan and Succession would not take you so for granted if she'd seen you as the dreamboat Mr. Darcy in the Joe Wright production.
Yeah, Tom Wormsgans is a long way from Mr. Darcy.
you have this kind of, you know, you're tall and this high-collared gentleman's, you know, dress with the shaggy haircut. He's sort of an aloof, distant character, but there's really a lot more to him. Was it at all intimidating to play this kind of literary figure, which had been done a lot before, you know, by Colin Firth a few years before?
Yeah, it had. I was quite intimidating. It was, really. I tried not to, you know, I think inevitably you worry about getting it right. And I didn't feel I was dishy enough and sort of brooding enough. And, you know, in your mind's eye as an actor, you always want to be a little more this or a little more that.
So how did you find dishy?
Well, I don't know. I just hope for the best. I don't know. I sort of decided that he was a bit sort of like a tortured adolescent, Mr. Darcy, which in a way he was. He was, you know, he's grieving his parents. He's inherited this vast estate and responsibility. And yeah, he's sort of all conflicted and torn up. And so I thought, that'll be my way into him.
Well, you know, there's an internet meme that developed out of a small quiet moment in that film early on. I mean, I'm sure you know this. I mean, where you're helping
the hand,
Elizabeth Bennet, played by Keira Knightley, out of a carriage. You don't really know each other well, and she didn't particularly like you, but you take her hand to help her into the carriage. And as you're walking away, the camera catches you flexing the hand, you know, having had this incidental contact. She's looking back at you. There's a lot of internet stuff on this. I saw one. I learned this from our digital producer, Molly C.V. Nesper, who says this has gotten a lot of attention. There was one TikTok of a woman who got a tattoo of your hand and Keira Knightley's.
You're kidding.
On her shoulder. Yeah.
He's so buttoned up, he can't show a thing.
Was this scripted? Was this planned all along, that shot?
No, it's credit to Joe because I think he doesn't miss a trick and he's so alive to things and he saw me do it in a rehearsal or a take, and I remember him just going, get that. So they just did an extra shot on the hand. You know, they were already on a sort of tracking shot. So, yeah.
I wanted to talk about a TV series that Americans may have seen you in. It was called Quiz. I think it was produced by Independent Television in Great Britain and shown on AMC. Is that right?
That's right, yeah.
And it's about the true story of a man in England who happened to be a major in the British Army, Charles Ingram, who appeared on the show Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, which originated in the UK. And he wins £1 million and then is accused with his wife, Diana, and eventually convicted of cheating to get the answers. So this is a real story. It was based on a play by James Graham, right? You want to explain how the cheating occurred, how the couple supposedly – how Charles knew what answers to give?
Well, I'm not sure that I can because he was convicted of cheating through a sort of system of... They alleged that he had an accomplice in the audience who was coughing at the right answers, you know, when they're sort of read out, and that was how he did it. But he denies this. They both deny this to this day. But the jury found them guilty and they were given a suspended sentence. And
right, and I think they have an active appeal, I believe.
I think they might do. Yeah, they were quite pleased when the show came out because it meant they could sort of get their case back, you know, back into the public eye and get it going again. But just a fascinating story.
I've got a scene we should hear. This is a scene where you, as Charles Ingram, is on the show, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, and you're taking a question. You've advanced to the level where £500,000 is at stake. And here you're being asked a question by the host, Chris Tarrant, who's actually played by Michael Sheen. So he asked the question, and it takes a while for you to answer. Let's listen.
For half a million pounds, Baron Haussmann is best known for the planning of which city? Rome, Paris, Berlin, Athens.
I think it's Berlin. Yeah, Berlin, I mean, Haussmann, you know, seems like a German name rather than an Italian name or a Parisian name or an Athens name. Rome, Paris. Yeah, do you know, I'm gonna rethink it because I don't think it's Athens, and I'm pretty sure it's not Rome, and I would have thought it was Berlin, but there's a chance it could be Paris. Yeah, I think it's Paris. I'm going to play.
Hang on, now, wait. Where are we?
No, Paris. Paris. Final answer.
Final answer.
Final answer.
Thought it was Berlin. 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 Change your mind to Paris. That's brought you £500,000!
Oh, the excitement, the tension. Oh, that is our guest, Matthew McFadden, in the series quiz. Also in that scene was Michael Sheen.
That was such fun to do because they built this studio. You know, they built this amazing set. It was exactly as it was. So it was really... So it's not hard to... my heart was banging away because it's... You know, you're there. It's not a leap of the imagination to think, oh, my God, I'm actually doing it.
Yeah, yeah. You know, Michael Sheen playing Chris Tarrant there is just, it just hands it up beautifully. I mean, it's so much fun.
Brilliant. Yeah.
And what happens, of course, we hear you saying each possible answer. And then if you listen carefully, there is a cough a couple of times when Paris.
There's a cough and there's a sort of confirmatory cough.
Right.
After
right.
the second time he says Paris, yeah.
Right. And what's interesting about, I think, I gather the play and certainly the series is that it doesn't really quite take a position on whether they cheated or not, this couple. And I must pose a challenge as an actor. I mean, are you a clever thief, you know, disguising your crime, or are you someone unjustly accused?
I'm still sort of agnostic about it. I really don't know. And Sian Clifford, who played Diana, and I would sort of meet in the morning every morning in the makeup bus and go, those guilty bastards, they did it. And then the next morning we'd say, no, I don't think they did. I think they're the victims of a stitch up. And we would change our minds constantly. And at the end, we sort of settled into sort of happy ambivalence. And we would... Stephen Frears, the director, would sort of say, well, let's, you know, on this take, maybe let's dial up the culpability a wee bit, and then maybe let's sort of be a bit more innocent on the next one. And so he had options in the cutting room, I suppose. But yeah, I don't know, is the answer.
Right, you don't know. I mean, one of the things that comes out, which has come out subsequently, is that while there were coughs associated with correct answers, there was a total of 192 coughs over the course of the broadcast. So the accusation is that the prosecution...
Exactly. And the episode in question was never broadcast, of course, because it was ITV's. And once they realized something was up, and so the ITV, and they admit this, they doctored the, you know, that episode to show the jury. You know, there were hundreds of coughs all over it, but I think they sort of pulled up the volume.
It was a really celebrated case, and I gather that the couple got coughed at by people on the street as a way of mocking them.
Yeah, they had a dreadful, torrid, horrible time afterwards.
You know, one more thing. During the pandemic, when, you know, many of us were, you know, resigned to our homes, you live in London with your wife, Keely Hawes, who's an actress, and you have teenage kids, right? You did kind of a home cooking show for television. Do I have this right?
Yeah, we did. We did something called Come Dine With Me, which is, I don't know if they have it in the States. It's, we all did a meal on consecutive nights and then judged it. And there was a small cash prize.
You and your wife and each of your kids kind of competed to cook the best meal?
Yeah. And they were very competitive. It got quite ugly towards the end. and I lost. And I think I'm a really good cook. But we had a nice time in the pandemic. It was good. Lockdown was all right. I think we realized that we all got on and the weather was good. And, you know, I think it was a sort of different experience. It was very interesting going to New York, actually, after, you know, to start work on Succession, because there was a totally different feeling in New York. I think just the geography of the city and what had happened, you know, at the height of it, it was just a lot more frightening.
Well, Matthew McFadden, it's been fun. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Oh, you're most welcome. Real pleasure. Thanks, Dave.
Matthew McFadden plays Tom Wamsgans in the HBO series Succession. He spoke with Fresh Air's Dave Davies. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Thea Challoner, Seth Kelly, and Kayla Lattimore. Our digital media producer is Molly C.V. Nesper. I'm Terry Gross.